the difficulty and importance of the global warming campaign is many times greater than every other environmental struggle. Controlling carbon pollution requires a wholesale industrial restructuring and the defeat of the most powerful industry lobby that has ever been assembled. Yet, in the face of this challenge, I think it's true to say that environmentalism in Australia has lost its way. At an event a few weeks ago, I put forward three reasons for the failure of environmentalism. First, I think, and let me just begin very briefly just by summarising what I said, like most Australians, some environmentalists, I think, find it hard to accept what the climate scientists are really saying. They don't believe, in their hearts, that things can be as bad as the science indicates. Like all of us, they are prone to wishful thinking and to clinging to false hopes. Secondly, some environmental groups, not all, but some have adopted for an incrementalist approach, the belief that small step-by-step changes are the only way forward because the political system and the public are unwilling to accept major changes. Thirdly, over the last couple of decades, environmental activism has been professionalised. The professionalisation of politics generally has seen a sharp decline in the membership of the mainstream political parties and a rise of the so-called political class, consisting of career politicians, staffers, spin doctors and apparatchiks. Some environmental NGOs have simply adapted to this new political landscape, and so the political class has become the new targets of their activities. So these NGOs have abandoned activism for the techniques of lobbying and media management and are now dominated by people with those sorts of skills. In other words, they've become insiders. As insiders, they're subject to all of the pressures and inducements that the powerful can mobilise: access to ministers, being consulted, having journalists ask your opinion, and so on. In the face of the failure of mainstream environmentalism to achieve significant progress on the biggest issue that it will ever face, we need a new environmental radicalism. Now, many in the environment movement are fearful of radicalism because they believe it will turn off voters. Yet, given the cavernous gap between the far-reaching actions demanded by the science and the tokenistic actions the public seems willing to support, I think Australians need to be thoroughly shaken up. Not long ago, I was watching an episode of the TV serial Mad Men, set in New York's Madison Avenue in the early 1960s. And there's a nice or illustrative scene in it where Betty Draper, she's the beautiful and self-absorbed wife of the show's main character, advertising executive Don Draper. And Betty arrives home to find her black housekeeper, Carla, listening to the radio, from which the voice of Martin Luther King Jr. can be heard giving a moving speech. When Betty comes in, Carla quickly turns off the radio. "Who was that?" asks Betty. "That was Dr. King speaking at the funeral of the little girls. In 1963, four black girls were killed in Birmingham, Alabama, where the church they were in was bombed by white supremacists." "It's a terrible thing," says Betty. "I'm not sure America is ready for civil rights just yet." After a strategy in the first half of the 20th century emphasising public education, litigation and political lobbying, in the 1950s the civil rights movement embarked on a campaign of mass civil disobedience: marches, boycotts, sit-ins, freedom rides and non-violent resistance. They directly confronted racism wherever they found it. Their activities alienated large sections of the white population, who felt threatened and enraged. Their protests and actions created crisis situations that the authorities didn't know how to handle, but which often played to their advantage. Like Betty Draper, most white Americans may not have been ready for civil rights, but that did not diminish the urgency or rightness of the cause or the strategy that had been adopted. Americans had to be made ready for civil rights. The same pattern defined the early phases of the women's movement. In Britain, after women's suffrage bills were defeated in Parliament by the main parties in the 1870s, 1880s and 1890s, some activists became frustrated with moderation and reasonableness of working within a system controlled by men. After all, some moderate women's groups, accepting the argument that many people in Britain believed that married women already in effect had the vote because their husbands voted for them, some of these moderate women's groups decided to be pragmatic, to take one step at a time, and advocated voting rights for single women only. Emily Pankhurst, on the other hand, declaring a commitment to deeds, not words, she and the suffragettes engaged in direct confrontation with oppressive institutions at every turn. They attacked the major political parties and refused to become the lapdogs of powerful men. For their militancy, they were reviled by the defenders of the old order, denounced by the press, and criticised by many who said they supported women's rights. Members of the Progressive Liberal Party assaulted physically Pankhurst and her supporters, blaming them or their radicalism for a Conservative win in a by-election. So there were plenty of timid people telling the leaders of the civil rights movement and the suffragettes that they must not push too hard or demand too much because society was not ready for change. But it was only by pushing hard that the civil rights radicals and the suffragettes made society ready for change. Naming Emily Pankhurst one of the 100 most important people of the 20th century, Time magazine wrote, "She shook society into a new pattern from which there could be no going back." I think that must be our strategy. In the case of climate change, gradualism is disastrous. For women's suffrage and civil rights, the price of gradualism was in the earlier phases, perhaps 2, 3, or 4 more decades of discrimination. In the case of climate change, the price of gradualism is the battle lost, because a delay to doing what we must for another 2 decades will lock in our fate for 1,000 years. The women's movement and the civil rights movement had history on their side and were always going to succeed sooner or later. The environment movement also has history on its side, and it has something even more powerful and tangible, the relentless force of scientific facts. Yet incrementalism reinforces a political system that acts above all else to maintain the structure of power. A system dominated by parties that always put the interests of the economy, of economic growth, and corporations first. Parties that have shown themselves to be dragging the chain at best, or actually taking us backwards. When Carla turned off the radio after her mistress arrived home unexpectedly, Betty Draper said to her, "It's okay, you can listen to your program." And I was reminded of this by an astonishing headline a couple of months ago in the business pages of the Sydney Morning Herald. It read, "In a blow to environmentalists, the International Energy Agency forecasts world energy consumption will continue to rise sharply and CO2 emissions will jump." One thing is now very clear. In the case of climate change, the public has adopted a range of strategies to avoid the truth. They don't want real action on climate change. They only want symbolic action that will require nothing of them. And the current carbon tax debate is proof of that. Sometimes coaxing the public to your point of view reaches an immovable barrier. Sometimes people must be jolted out of their complacency by militancy, even if that means a period of rancour, turmoil, and danger. The task of environmental campaigners is not to pander to public evasions, but to make those evasions untenable, to blast away the pretenses people use to blind themselves to the science, to make them see what's coming down the road at all of us. A wave of environmental radicalism, of uncivil disobedience, will have succeeded when the conservative press begin praising Bob Brown and Christine Milne as voices of reason and moderation, as indeed they are. The most committed defenders of the status quo are those who most fear environmentalism, the greenhouse mafia, the mining corporations, the defenders of the establishment in the Liberal Party and the ALP, and their boosters and apologists in the media. These conservatives see environmentalism as a profound threat to their world. Unfortunately, the threat posed by environmentalism is not nearly as great as they imagine, and is diminished by the actions of pale greens everywhere who believe that working within the system and massaging the public can save us from climate catastrophe. In the early 1990s and perhaps the early years of the 2000s, there was some justification for the incrementalist strategy. But climate science now shows that the situation has become so urgent and the forecast so dire that only radical social and economic transformation will give us a fighting chance of avoiding dramatic and irreversible changes to the global climate. So let me leave you with this final thought. The historic responsibility of environmentalism cannot be overstated. Beyond women's suffrage, beyond civil rights, its mission is nothing less than saving humanity as a whole. And so today's environmentalism, I'd suggest, is no place for the faint-hearted.